The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Monday, April 15th, 2024. 7 minutes past the hour, I'm Eric White filling in for Tom Temin. Our producer is Peter Masurlian. Our web editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up this hour of The Federal Drive, a lot of agencies are talking about AI, but are they putting their money where their mouth is? Plus, how the Postal Service is fighting back against crimes against the mail system. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, over the past several years, the Navy's been using a sweeping process improvement effort to wring almost $1 billion in savings out of its supply chains. It's all happened under a project called Naval Sustainment System Supply. Now, under a 2.0 version of NSS Supply, the focus is changing to boosting the readiness of the Navy's ship and aircraft fleets. For more on how it's all going, Federal News Network's Jared Serbu spoke with Commander Kurt Engler, the director of NSS Supply at Naval Supply Systems Command, and Melissa Olson, the project's deputy director.
Quite simply, when we started, we were very focused on value capture. We used a commercial model and value-wise, like cost savings and cost avoidance on each initiative. And we had a North Star that was really our supply figure of merit North Star that didn't really resonate quite well with the 3 and 4 stars and their North Stars. So, we really do know what the sub boss wants, the submarine community, the aviation, the air boss, and then also the SWO boss, the surface warfare community. And we're aligning now to their North Stars. So while it was once about value, and we captured $837 million worth in value, we had taken and ran through like 30 initiatives approximately in the last 4 years. And then now we're focused on our supply chain contribution to the 3 North Stars, the fleet North Stars. And that's really the difference between 1.0 and NSS Supply 2.0.
What about that figure of merit North Star that you talked about? First of all, describe a little bit about what that was and then why it didn't resonate with those operational communities.
Okay, so we really simply computed it as readiness over the cost of readiness. Mm-hmm. So the cost of buying that readiness, whether it was for the surface community. We were saying, hey, we're saving or we're doing cost avoidance. And we took our cash from kind of a low cash solvency position to $2.1 billion to the right. But that didn't really mean anything to the warfare officers because we really weren't showing them how we were contributing to their North Stars. So if the surface warfare officer, Vice Admiral Kitchener at the time, wants to get to 75 mission-capable, ready combat ships, we weren't translating our North Star into how we were, closing the gap to their 75 mission-capable ships. So we're really, Admiral Epps, who is the commander of NAVSUP, really wants us to align and try to close the gap analysis on how supply, in particular, can close the gap to, let's say, getting 80% of submarines available and getting 100% of material for the shipyards there at start of availability. So it's plain and simple that we're now aligned to their readiness North Stars, and it means more within the Pentagon. It means more to the fleet warfighter. We're not trying to have to make a bridge and leap ourselves to how us saving or valuizing ourselves contributes to their North Star.
So not to oversimplify too much, but it sounds like the bottom line on all that is the message back to you from the rest of the community was, show me how these get better plans improve my readiness. Is that
exactly
fair?
Exactly. Yes. Quite simply, we're not having to make kind of like that leap to explain to them, commercial industry does it this way. They're more lean. They're more efficient. And then translate that to, how does that help my North Star? We just are going right to the root causes, the diagnostics of what's holding up their 75 mission capable or their 80% ready submarines from a materials or supply chain perspective. We are the get better side of that analytics, that data analytics. So we don't have to, I guess, make the leap. We just can say, hey, you know, you're tracking with us. This is your gap analysis. This is where our root causes are, and we're leaning into those for supply.
So is 2.0 more of a shift in how you communicate what you're doing to the rest of those partners, or actually, are you actually doing different things in those get better plans, or is it a bit of both?
I would say it's both, honestly.
Yeah, but it is a mindset shift from valuizing, if that's even a term.
Let's go with
I'll
it.
I'll make it up.
Yeah.
Monetizing or putting some financial value to readiness versus actually delivering that readiness to the fleet. It's a mind shift, but it's a mind shift that helps us talk the same language to our mission partners. They don't want to hear that you got that part just in time to them. They want to know that every time they need it. When NSS 1.0, NSS Supply 1.0 came about, really it was peacetime, right? We didn't have the challenges we have in Ukraine. We didn't have the challenges we have in Israel. We weren't dealing with Houthis in the Red Sea. Those challenges that we're facing now are more phase two wartime challenges, right? And you can't have just-in-time logistics in wartime. Changing to NSS Supply's mindset to a readiness mindset allows the supply system to be responsive and flexible and agile for the warfighter so that they meet mission requirements.
So can you give us any examples of what that actually looks like? What are some of the things these teams might be focused on under 2.0, or is it still too early?
It's not too early. In Wave 7, Melissa mentioned we've done 30 initiatives across six waves. In Wave 7, we were looking at several symptoms. We discovered they were symptoms, right? Unfilled customer orders, requisitions in the shipyards that were essentially also unfilled customer orders, and we called them jeopardy requisitions because they were jeopardizing the completion of the avails. But those were just symptoms of upstream supply chain issues, which we were able to quickly see through the Agile framework. Hey, these things are manifesting themselves from problems that really are coming from upstream. For instance, we have not been, as a Navy, been very disciplined in our modeling efforts, which allowance the parts that a ship needs. For instance, until recently, the SPY radar, the Aegis radar system, had not been remodeled in over 12 years. When you rerun the model, you take into account updated failure rates, updated demand rates, updated repair rates, all of the things that are taken into account when you look at a system's operational availability. Mean time between failure, mean time between repair, mean logistics downtime. All those factors really go into how confident will I be that the system is online. So when we started saying there's a problem with modeling, we can start to see in the future how that remodeling effort is going to improve downstream allowancing onboard the ships, meaning the ships will have exactly the parts that they need on board instead of an older model when maybe the system was brand new and we didn't know how often the parts would fail or how long it would take to get a new part on board.
That's Commander Kurt Engler, the director of the Naval Sustainment System Supply Project at Naval Supply Systems Command, along with Melissa Olson, the deputy director. They spoke with Federal News Network's Jared Serbu. You can find more of Jared's reporting at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come on Federal News Network, how the Postal Service is fighting back against crimes against the mail system. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White, filling in for Tom.
Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. The U.S. Postal Inspection Service recently gave an update on its Project Safe Delivery. It's been a year-long effort by the agency to prevent threats and attacks on letter carriers and mail theft incidents. Joining us with some details about the progress that the agency has made, Michael Martell from the USPIS. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Absolutely. So why don't we just start from the beginning? Tell me about Project Safe Delivery and what it is aiming to do, and then we can kind of get into what it has done.
Sure. So last May, Project Safe Delivery was launched, and that is a joint initiative between the Postal Service and the Postal Inspection Service to address the recent rise in threats and attacks on our letter carriers and mail theft incidents, and of course, to keep the nation's mail and packages safe.
And how does it go about doing that when you say it shows initiative? Is it just mostly going after specifically those crimes, or is there just a more onus on it? Because that sounds like it should just be, you know, business as usual for the inspection service.
Actually, it's not. This is, like I said, a joint venture between the Postal Service and the Inspection Service. So we're not going at it alone here. So it employs a holistic approach to address these crimes. We seek to, you know, protect postal employees and the mail stream, prevent incidents from occurring through education and awareness, and of course, as postal inspectors, enforce the laws that protect the nation's mail stream.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is, in addition, you're getting some help from other agencies and law enforcement partners. Who would those partners be? Is that local and other federal enforcement agencies, or who else are you working with?
First and foremost, the Postal Service. They're out there delivering every day, and they're the ones that are upgrading sort of the physical security of our blue collection boxes and locks, and, you know, the letter carriers that are serving the American people on the street every day. But of course, federal law enforcement partners, to state and local law enforcement partners, as well as prosecutors, federal, state, and local prosecutors as well. All of those parties are really helping us make a difference here.
Gotcha. Okay. And before, I promise we'll get to the results shortly, but, you know, just on background, again, you had mentioned the rise in crimes against postal workers and mail theft incidents. Was there a catalyst that you all really identified that before, you know, something was finally said, all right, we got to do something about this? You know, what was the thought process there before initiating Project Safe Delivery?
So really, after coming out of the pandemic, after the pandemic, we saw a rise in letter carrier robberies and associated mail theft. So robberies of our carriers for access devices to the mail stream. Those individuals then would sell that access device or use it to steal mail themselves and commit associated financial crimes.
Gotcha. Okay. And you all were just paying attention and just saw that the numbers were just creeping up and up and thought, okay, we really got to do something about this. And, you know, this isn't business as usual.
Well, absolutely. So remember, letter carriers are fellow postal employees to us in the inspection service. And letter carriers are out there on the street serving the American people day in and day out. They're being accosted just trying to do their jobs. And that's something that we take to heart here at the Inspection Service, and we really need to provide them the level of protection they deserve.
We're speaking with Michael Martell, who is with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. So let's get into what has been the effects so far. You all have put out an update on exactly what you all have found and how you have stepped up enforcement. What have you all been able to accomplish so far?
When it comes to upgrades to protect the mail stream, the Postal Service has installed over 15,000 high-security blue collection boxes. Those boxes look the same on the outside, but feature a number of upgrades on the inside to defend against a variety of attacks. And they've also installed over 30,000 electronic locking mechanisms. And that electronic component provides a lot of capability when it comes to being able to secure the mail stream after an incident and, of course, thwarting these criminals, taking away the very thing that they're after in these robberies, and that's access to the mail stream.
Gotcha. And as far as protecting the mail carriers themselves, what actions have been taken in way of ensuring that these postal employees that you mentioned are fully protected and that the laws going against them are, there's usually the complaint of, you know, these crimes are perpetrated and then nothing really happens about them. How are you all making sure that you see through the end that enforcement is taking place?
That couldn't be further from the truth, Eric. So as part of Project Safe Delivery, we've made over 213 arrests since the start of the project for specific postal-related robberies. And we've made well over 1,000 arrests since the start of the initiative in regards to mail theft. And really, I have some trends here over this past 6 months. So in the past 6 months, letter carrier robberies or postal-related robberies are down by 21% versus the same time period the previous year. And number of arrests associated with postal robberies are up 72%, again, in that same time period. And what we're seeing as well is mail theft complaints are down about 35% in that time period. What that's doing is showing these efforts are paying off and they're making a difference.
Gotcha. And what about the folks that it actually affects? I know that you had mentioned complaints of mail theft have gone down, but what about the postal carriers themselves? Are you hearing positive results from them and they feel a little bit safer and not as vulnerable when they are out there, like you said, just doing their jobs?
I think there's always progress to be made there. I think those numbers sort of speak for themselves. But in addition to those, something that's been highly effective is the large increase in the reward program for postal-related crimes. So as of right now, if you rob one of our Postal Service letter carriers, there is a price of up to $150,000 on your head after that incident. That's more than triple than it was before the program rolled out.
And more than likely, what you're stealing from that mail carrier is not going to be worth $150,000 if that's usually the case, right?
No, I mean, you know, I don't know what your electric bill is worth, but, you know, if they want that, they can have it.
And as far as technologies, you had mentioned the new high security blue collection boxes, electric lock mechanisms. You know, obviously, you know, you may not want to give away too many secrets, but are there other areas that you all are looking into as far as improving the actual technology that the Postal Service uses and ways to secure that?
Of course, Eric, we're always evaluating the current environment and looking for ways that we can enhance the security of the mail stream. And the upgrades that you just mentioned, not only are we putting those items out, but as they're rolling out, we're doing so strategically and to maximize their effect out on the streets. And as of right now, high security collection boxes and those electronic locking mechanisms have been deployed to all 50 states.
And you're getting some help as well from technology that the Postal Service isn't even responsible for. You know, everybody has a Ring camera now on the front of their door mostly, and I'm sure that they have caught several incidents of people breaking into mailboxes or even going after postal employees. Are you all utilizing any other technologies that, as I said, you know, aren't necessarily yours, but you'll take any help you can get?
I mean, it brings up a greater point. The public can, of course, help us in our mission to keep your letter carrier safe. They're serving you in your community on a daily basis. So if you have Ring doorbell footage of an incident, reach out to the Postal Inspection Service at 1-877-876-2455. But in addition to that, you can keep an eye out for your letter carrier. If you see someone suspicious around a mail receptacle or following your letter carrier, call 911 and then report it to the Inspection Service.
And let's talk timeline. You know, this is obviously something that you all are happy about the results that you're seeing. Is this going to be a continued effort for the foreseeable future, or is this going to just kind of be the norm as we go further?
Well, absolutely. We are not done. There are thousands more of these blue boxes and electronic locking mechanisms to be deployed, and many more efforts across the nation to, of course, enforce the law that protect the nation's mail system in the form of these law enforcement surges. And what that has done is the Postal Inspection Service is sending national law enforcement personnel, postal inspectors, and other personnel to the hardest hit areas for concentrated efforts. And we're seeing great results there as well.
Michael Martell is with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, and we'll be sure to have you back for an update. But thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
And you can find a link to more information along with this interview posted on our website. Head to federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Federal News Network, the Pfizer fight may be over, but what's next for Congress? But first, a lot of agencies are talking about AI, but are they putting their money where their mouth is? It's the Federal Drive with Tom Thiemann on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Thiemann here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom.
You've been hearing a lot about it lately, present radio program included. Federal agencies are looking at different ways they can utilize recent breakthroughs in artificial intelligence. But just how much of their budgets are agency leaders willing to put towards it? That was a question our next guest tried to answer. Greg Dawson is a professor at Arizona State University who recently conducted a study with the Brookings Institution to look at how the federal government has been purchasing AI. Professor Dawson, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So why don't we just start from the beginning and tell me what exactly you all were trying to find with this, was it a review or was it actually, research? What did you all undertake here?
Well, so this is our second paper in a series. We've been working with folks from Leadership Connect, and they, a couple of years ago, provided us all of the information on AI spending within the federal government. And it had been 18 months, 2 years since that last study. And so we wanted to see what had changed.
Well, a lot has changed, right? So, well, in the technology world, at least.
Yeah. Well, we were surprised how much the spending changed as well. In the report we did 18 months, 2 years ago, Department of Defense was about, 76% of federal AI spending. And they had about 250 contracts. This past set of data that we looked at, they are 95% of federal AI spending, the Department of Defense, and now have over 650 contracts. Sort of our interpretation of that is Department of Defense has found some use cases for AI, and they are moving from the thinking about it as concept to this is how we're going to practically implement it. We think that's exciting.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the big takeaways I took away from reviewing your research. Does the 95% number take into account that the Department of Defense, they do a lot of contracts anyway? Are they actually just purchasing the most AI in general, even taking into account how many contracts they do on a daily basis?
They are just purchasing the most AI in general. My colleague Jim Denford, who's a co-author on this paper, had the best line that if you look at federal AI spending, all other agencies other than Department of Defense are just rounding errors. The DOD is so prevalent in terms of where the spending is right.
Gotcha. All right. And were there any agencies that at least came a little bit close to at least, not being just a decimal point?
No, not really.
Wow.
I mean, the next couple of agencies were NASA and HHS, but they are just such in distant second and third place that they're almost irrelevant.
Gotcha. All right. And so how deep did you all dive into the kinds of AI technology? What did the numbers look like breaking down just the Department of Defense's purchases?
Yeah. So this is where it really got interesting because up till now, most of the spending has been on study related stuff. So the NAIC code, I think, was code number 51, which is all about studies and things like that. The shift now has been dramatically towards code 54, which is all about implementation work. So we've shifted from the study to the implementation. And as I said, clearly the Department of Defense has found some use cases for AI, and they're moving forward aggressively in doing it. And we can also see that with the with the different vendors. That the vendors that we looked at a couple of years ago were did a lot of study work, and now, as we predicted in our last study, so kudos to us for that. the integrators have moved in. So people like Accenture, Federal Services, who are all about implementation, they are now they're now a big player.
You use the prediction word. I'm going to hold you to that a little bit later. But first, let's let's reset here. Gregory Dawson is a professor at Arizona State University. We're discussing AI spending in the federal government. Looking through those vendors, is it a pretty good spread, or was it like a lot of the defense spending where there was the big five or anything like that? It seems as if there's a diverse group that the Defense Department is actually purchasing a sizable percentage from.
Yeah. And I'll go back to the P word, the prediction word. One of the things we noticed 18 months ago was, again, there was a whole bunch of small guys who curiously were often co-located with a military base. Now we thought the bigger guys would move in, and indeed the bigger guys have moved in. There's still a lot of spending on smaller companies as well, but the big guys have definitely moved in. And again, our speculation is that this has moved from, gee, what a quaint idea, to we've actually got some ways to be able to approach this, at least within the Department of Defense. you know, when we talk about other agencies, I'm not sure the same statement can be made.
Yeah, either that or the big guys bought the little guys to move in, because that's usually the case.
Entirely possible.
You know, I know that you said it's not even really sizable, but the agencies that are making those tiny purchases of AI, what are some of their use cases for it?
So it's not clear to us what their use cases are, and that's actually something that concerns us. You know, one of the things that we've talked about in our numerous Brookings reports is the fact that the way the U.S., as a country is approaching AI, is sort of, you know, to quote Chairman Mao for a moment, to let a thousand flowers bloom. So the U.S. as a country is looking very broadly and about AI and where AI spending could be, contrasted to China, for example. And China is all about, they've got two or three things that they're pushing forward. Our speculation is that eventually the U.S. approach of, you know, very diffuse spending is that it's impossible, or it becomes much more difficult to learn. There's a concept in education where the more you learn, the more you're capable of learning. Okay. The problem is if you're doing a whole lot of spending across a whole lot of different agencies, you don't have the opportunity to be able to learn those things. You know, Department of Defense is, you know, unquestionably doing it right in terms of going deep. These other agencies, I'm not sure that the learning is going to take place across agencies like we want to. And I know there's some federal regulations and boards set up to be able to address it. At this point, it seems like it's a lot more of a concept than actually being seen in practicality.
Yeah. And that provides me a perfect segue into my next question, which is, you know, not every agency has one, but a lot of them have put out, you know, artificial intelligence strategy. The White House has said some things about how they want agencies to using artificial intelligence. You know, if you put those strategies side by side with your research and the strategies on another screen, does it seem like they're matching up and agencies are doing what they set out to do regarding AI?
Yes, but. So are they approaching it that way? Yes. But I got to tell you, a lot of those plans are very aspirational in nature. You know, we want to be all things to all people and do good with it. I mean, that's good. But in terms of the practical implementation, that feels a little bit weak sauce to us.
Gotcha. All right. Well, so now I'm going to hold your feet to the fire. What are some of the predictions you think you'll all see? Or, you know, are you planning on continuing this research? I imagine you are. It's fascinating. And I can tell that you're very interested in it. You know, what are you all expecting to see the next go around?
So, yes, my colleagues and I certainly intend to continue our relationship with Leadership Connect, who's provided this, has provided all of the data to us. So what we expect to see in the future is, I think the Department of Defense models perfectly what other agencies are going to do. So the Department of Defense sort of, you know, nibbled around the edges for a couple of years looking at AI and has now found some use cases that it clearly views as worth exploring. We think that that's what the other agencies are doing now. They're just kind of dipping their big toe in the water to test their temperature. We have little doubt that they're going to be able to find some appropriate use cases, and that they'll probably be a couple of years behind where the Department of Defense is in terms of actually being able to implement these use cases. But again, I'm going to circle back to, man, this has got to be done in a coordinated fashion. If we're doing, you know, one-offs across all the different agencies, we're not taking advantage of the wisdom that can be gained from a more coordinated effort. Again, what the White House has put out in terms of their strategy is quite good in terms of coordination. We would really like to see that stronger and enacted more fully. But mark my words, and you know, let's have this conversation in a year or 18 months. I think we're going to see the shift to be fairly dramatic in terms of what other agencies have moved past the dipping the toe in the water aspirational to something where they're really no doubt implementing AI in the true sense of the word.
Yeah, we will definitely check back. I'll keep your email on file there so that we can weigh these predictions against what you all do find. Greg Dawson is a professor at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll post this interview along with a link to Greg's research at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Listen to the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Federal News Network, the FISA fight may be over, but what's next for Congress? It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom.
back on the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. The test cases keep piling up for Speaker of the House Mike Johnson as he continues the balancing act within his own party. Last week, it was all about FISA. Oh, yeah, and there is still this lingering question of helping out Israel and Ukraine. We get an update on everything going on in Congress this week and next from Bloomberg Government's Lauren Duggan. Lauren, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk FISA. It was all the rage yesterday, and a lot of members of Congress giving some impassioned takes about it. Where does FISA currently stand? And, you know, maybe even just give us a brief definition of what the FISA enactment would mean this go around.
Sure. So there's this Friday, April 19th deadline to do something about parts of the FISA law, in specific Section 702, which allows the collection of, it's supposed to be outside the U.S., but can at times sweep up U.S. persons' information as well. So this is a big civil rights, civil liberties debate couched within a larger debate about national security. And what we've seen here is an issue that can divide the parties in unusual ways, where some of the most liberal and most conservative members band together, and you kind of have this tier of national security establishment people on the other side and trying to thread that needle to get this reauthorized. Law enforcement FBI Director Chris Wray would say it's hugely important to get this done, and there's been some debate about whether they can get it done by the deadline and how to thread that needle. But a big issue with many consequences.
Yeah, you said it. You know, this is one of those issues that members of whatever party love to be able to take a stand, like you said, against folks even in their own party. You know, are we looking at some of the same usual folks, the Rand Pauls and the civil liberties folks who are banding together on this fight against the Section 702?
Absolutely. Rand Paul is somebody who's done this traditionally. Years ago, he forced a debate on a Sunday, I think it was, because there was another deadline and he wanted to have a discussion on the Senate floor about this. So some of the civil liberties types you'd see on both sides of the aisle have banded together here, like I said. And, you know, even people who before might have been against it, once they get more information as a leader like Speaker Johnson, have said, well, no, I have a slightly different perspective on this given what I've known and what I've heard. So yeah, it's a different sort of issue where, you know, party can come in. As we saw, it was Republicans who tanked the rule last week that slowed down this debate. But once they got it going again and could get the compromise to the floor, we saw some action happening.
One issue where party lines definitely do matter is the issue of the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas. Where does that currently stand? And is this impeachment that we've been hearing about for I don't know how long now, is it going to actually take place?
Well, we expect this week to see the House managers, the people that the House of Representatives have sent over to prosecute the case, will go over to the Senate, have their charges read, and then they will swear in the senators as a jury in a trial. The question is, will there be a trial? Some Democrats want to just dismiss it right away, but there is a large group of Republicans, I think more than, you know, almost all of them signed a letter saying we should have a trial. So there could be a lot of debate and discussion around that. Democrats, if they marshal the votes, could bring it to a pretty swift conclusion. But what Republicans have said is, if you do that, we might hold up other business and deny you unanimous consent to take up things you want to do or to move them quickly, at least. So I think we're not likely to see a long trial, if a trial at all. And these charges will likely end in dismissal because there's not 2/3 to remove him from office and convict him of the charges being sent over.
Yeah. And Mayorkas has done a pretty good job of just trying to stay out of the whole issue altogether. Has he said anything or given any inclination of how he feels about this?
I mean, I think you've said it. He was up on the Hill talking to appropriators. He's due to go up to the Hill and meet with Homeland Security Committee members this on Tuesday, I think it is, the same day they would march across and prosecute their case against him. So he's trying to do his job. He's trying to run all the things in the department and suffer, I guess he would say, the slings and arrows of what's coming at him from Capitol Hill. But, you know, I don't think the dynamic has changed. The criticisms of him from House Republicans, regardless of the trial, will remain for, you know, as long as he's in office, I would say.
One of the agencies that doesn't really make a lot of headlines will also be seeing several bills that could have an effect on the way they do business, and that's the Energy Department. What kind of legislation is up for debate now that is potentially going to affect enforcement rules for the Energy Department?
So the House is looking at taking up a number of bills this week dealing with energy efficiency standards for appliances. There's one broad bill that would remove a requirement that they do it, I think it is every 6 years, but instead, if there's a petition or something, you could redo these standards, but they would have to meet all sorts of criteria, including one that would make it really hard to ban gas stoves, which has been a debate that's come up here and there. Then there's several smaller bills that deal with individual requirements for things like washers, dryers, dishwashers, air conditioners. So taking aim at standards that could be put in place there. So it's a chance for Republicans to talk about what they see as ill-advised efficiency standards, and Democrats will probably take the opposite position and say that these are the right things to do to ensure that these appliances are better for the environment. So, you know, kind of a classic debate on those issues.
Will we hear testimony from the Maytag repairman?
He might be cited. You'll never know.
Lauren Duggan is with Bloomberg Government. And so also, Lauren, there are some other budgetary issues that are going to be taking place next week. Are there any other budget hearings that we can look forward to?
There are a lot, and this is the hearings for fiscal 2025, which starts October 1. I know we just finished the fiscal 2024 debates and in some ways are continuing them, but these, we're going to see more cabinet secretaries go up, whether it's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu, who's still filling in for that role while her confirmation is pending, and they will defend the budget and take questions from appropriators and authorizers on both sides of Capitol Hill. So that's really where we are with this budget season for the next year. Appropriators haven't really kicked into gear yet. That maybe we'll see that in May and once they're back from this upcoming 1 week break, but a long way to go, but this is an important early step.
And speaking of congressional fiscal decisions, there is still the lingering question of whether or not we're going to free up money for the nation of Ukraine and keep providing aid to Israel, despite some, pretty troubling headlines that have angered a few members of Congress. What is the latest as far as foreign aid goes, especially for those two nations?
There could be a push this week to do that. The Senate passed its bill several months ago now that had money for Ukraine and Israel and the Indo-Pacific. That's been frozen in the House for now. There's this discharge petition to try and break it loose, but it doesn't have the requisite majority it would need. And some of those signatures would have to come from Republicans who at this stage seem unlikely to do so. So if Speaker Johnson can thread the needle on this, I use that phrase a lot, but it's a tough path. If he can come up with some sort of package that can win enough support, maybe we'll see a vote this week before they head out for a 1 week recess that's scheduled. But if not, then we could see another week or several go without action on this. And if the House doesn't pass what the Senate did, it has to go back to the Senate and they would have to resolve that too. So we could still be a little ways away from a resolution on this question.
Yeah, like you said, you keep on having to use the phrase thread the needle. No real honeymoon period at all for Speaker Mike Johnson. I mean, he has been facing some tough debates, like you said, between his own party and, of course, with Democrats. I mean, in the historical context, has there been a speaker that has been run through the gamut as fast as Speaker Mike Johnson?
I think he's got an unusual lineage here. And of course, there's a threat hanging over his head from Marjorie Taylor Greene to possibly oust him or at least force a vote on ousting him 5 months or whatever into the job. And when we just had the first speaker ever thrown out by his own party in the middle of a Congress, as we saw with Kevin McCarthy. So it's been a really tough conference to manage, maybe even impossible at times. I'm sure it feels that way. But that's a dynamic that's been real in this very narrowly divided House with, you know, we kind of overlooked the very narrowly divided Senate, but it's a really unusual kind of time in Congress.
Lauren Duggan is Deputy News Director at Bloomberg Government. Thanks as always, Lauren.
Thank you.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com. You can subscribe to The Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. 57 past the hour. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Up next, the top national headlines from CBS News and the Federal Newscast. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom.
From PR to paid programs, learn what marketing is working for government contractors. Federal News Network. Search Amtower Off-Center.
Agencies are overlooking a prime opportunity to reduce the size of the federal real estate footprint and save billions in the process. That's coming from the Public Buildings Reform Board, an independent agency focused on selling valuable but underutilized government buildings. It finds agencies have more office space than the federal workforce needs and that the cost of maintaining this space keeps going up. For more, Federal News Network's Jory Heckman spoke with a member of the board and a former commissioner of the Public Building Service, Dan Matthews.
We think there really is a win-win opportunity. Purpose of the board has never been more relevant than today, given the really low levels of occupancy. But the win-win opportunity there really is to realign the federally owned portfolio in a way that is more cost-effective for taxpayers, better quality for agency's mission, and good for the local jurisdictions. Because basically having an empty federal building that no one's going to doesn't do anything for the local economy. It's actually quite a harmful economic dead zone. So that's not really in anybody's interest. But making the changes is not easy to do. It takes leadership. It takes people that are really focused on something else to make a decision and then move forward. Not terribly difficult to execute on if you can get the right leadership to make the right decisions. But getting people to pay attention, that's really, I think, the crux of the matter. But the status quo is just indefensible.
To that point, you guys mentioned in the report how you guys have brought this to the attention of PBS Commissioner Elliot Dooms. Dan, obviously, that's a position you previously held. You understand what it takes to get this done. What was ultimately your pitch to him, and how was that received?
You know, we were colleagues on the Transportation Committee together as well. So we both worked on writing this legislation. So, you know, he completely understands the purpose of it, the need for it, and wants it to be successful. And just as when I was commissioner, I was very invested in its success, clearly understood the need for it. And you know, he expressed the same to us. So I think we're very encouraged that he will also give the support of PBS to the board so the board can, you know, carry out its mission.
You were saying a moment ago about the utilization data that you guys kind of took a step further from what GAO did last summer with the utilization report they did, that you guys did this, I think, really fascinating dive on the public cell phone data out there and use that as kind of a proxy for utilization at these federal buildings. Tell me how that got started and what you guys find there, because it seems like you guys get at the same conclusion as GAO that these buildings are just massively underutilized.
I'd say one thing, the data is anonymized, right? So there is no identifiable information that the board ever had. So I think that's important to point out at the outfront for federal employees. Two, it's very accurate. And it was for an entire year, actually for 2 years, the year of 2019 and the year of 2023, whereas the GAO's data was card swipe data just for a couple of weeks, a few weeks during a few months in a particular year. So a much larger data set, I think also a better picture, it creates a better picture of actual utilization in these buildings. And as you saw in the report, it's really quite low. And so what that means is the cost to the taxpayer is spending a tremendous amount of money to house an extremely small number of people in buildings that, frankly, are pretty awful oftentimes. So they're spending a fortune, they're getting not much for it, and the outcomes are bad. So again, it's not really defensible. And so many of these buildings have capital liabilities that are extraordinarily high. And given the low utilization, it just doesn't pencil out, right? You can't justify spending that type of money to renovate a building when there's such low utilization. And I would draw a distinction between the monumental historic buildings on Constitution Avenue and a lot of the mid-century 1950s, 60s GSA-owned buildings that are frankly an eyesore and also have massive capital liabilities. GSA doesn't have enough money to take care of all of them. You got to make hard choices. And I think it's pretty clear which ones you ought to be getting rid of and which ones you ought to be putting your capital into and investing in so you can keep them in good condition. So it works for the agencies and works for the employees, and you've got better utilization and lower per person cost for taxpayers. That's the solution.
Speak to a little bit more about that, because I think that's a thing that obviously strikes a nerve with some people. The age and condition of some of these federal buildings. The report mentions how, you know, on average, some of these buildings are 50 years old and they're showing their age, and that GSA, to your point, just doesn't have the capital to make these buildings the kind of hospitable work environments that federal employees want and deserve. Can you spend a little bit more time there going into the condition of these buildings and how it's just such a situation that GSA would be sinking billions of dollars into this for maybe very little return on investment, I guess?
Yeah, the reality is for most of these projects, you wouldn't have any return on investment, meaning that the cost GSA would have to spend to renovate the buildings and the amount of rent they would be able to charge their customer agencies, there would be no return on it. They would be losing money. And in those situations, they should be looking towards a lease solution. If they cannot generate a return on investment for the federal building, they should be, that should be on a path of disposal, and the alternative should be to lease. Now, there are some federal buildings where they could generate a return on investment because the amount of capital necessary is quite a bit less than a full building renovation. And it may be in a good location, a relatively new building. A perfect example of that is the Department of Transportation headquarters, right? It's less than 20 years old. It's in great condition. It also has pretty low occupancy. You could easily have additional Department of Transportation components occupy that building at a relatively low investment level. On the other hand, you know, take a building like, I think we mentioned the Francis Perkins building in the report, that's considerably older, has massive capital liabilities. Really, most of their major systems are past their useful life. Occupancy is very low. It's pretty much impossible. The amount of money you'd have to spend in that building per foot, you're just not going to be able to pencil out. You're not going to get a return on investment on that. And those are, you know, just two examples of how, you know, I think a real estate owner, developer would look at these projects in the private sector and say, what do we do with this building? Would we invest in it or would we not invest in it? And I think those are just examples of both sides of that equation.
Going back to the board's use of the cell phone data and the utilization rates that you guys found, I'm particularly struck by that because, like you said, you know, it's a year-long look at data. It fills in some of the gaps, I feel, that GAO didn't quite address with just its limited snapshot of its data, particularly because what we kind of saw since last fall was the Biden administration calling for, you know, a greater return to office for federal employees. And it seems like based on the data that you guys have captured, that has really moved the needle in any kind of way, that underutilization still remains the case here for a lot of buildings.
I would say I think that utilization data will be very helpful to the government in executing on its decisions to, you know, increase the return to office. I mean, the White House has made that pretty clear. That's a priority. But if you don't have the data to know, is it actually happening? That makes it challenging, right? So I'm hopeful that putting some of this data out there will actually make those decision makers, will help them in implementing those decisions if that's what they want to do. It's available for Congress. It's available for, you know, the administration itself.
That was Dan Matthews, a member of the Public Buildings Reform Board and former commissioner of GSA's Public Building Service, speaking with Federal News Network's Jory Heckman.